This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. In the 1990s, officials founded five international criminal tribunals to prosecute war crimes and crimes against humanity, atrocities like mass killings, genocide, recruiting child soldiers, mass war, rape. These are some of the atrocities that are included in these crimes. Four of these tribunals were temporary to charge individuals involved in specific events. The fifth is still around today, the International Criminal Court. David Crane is the founding chief prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. He's also co-editor of The Founders, four pioneering individuals who launched the first modern-era international criminal tribunals. He's giving a talk tonight at North Carolina State University about contemporary challenges to modern international criminal law, but he joins us now on The State of Things. David, welcome. Good to be here.
Thank you. It's great to be here this afternoon.
The subject of your talk, of course, is the challenges to international justice. I mean, we're familiar vaguely. We've probably heard of the International Criminal Court. Certainly we know about the Nuremberg trial. So we've got some vague idea. What is the state of international criminal justice today? What stands ready to take these cases?
Yeah, we live in an amazing kaleidoscopic age. Never would I have thought when the Soviet Union dissolved and the wall came down that 25 years later we would be worried about a democratic peace, international peace and security. I would never have in my wildest dreams imagined the rise of the strong man again. It's almost comparable to the late 1920s and the early 1930s, where we see the rise of the Hitlers of the world, the Stalins, the Mussolinis. We have that happening right before our very eyes. It impacts on the concept of the rule of law and international peace and security, which centered on the law. And so those of us who, over the past couple decades, have been working hard to seek justice for victims of atrocity, this inward-looking aspect of this nationalism does impact on the international aspects of holding people accountable.
That's what I was going to say. This is central to all of this. The anxieties, of course, created by a global capitalist society are what generate these kinds of fears. Paradoxically, it's the thing that causes it that you gravitate to. Certainly, that's what happened in the 30s, and we're seeing it again. And yet, as you say, it's also hand-in-hand with nationalism, which is antithetical to the idea of any kind of international standard, and at precisely the moment when we need it most. So what are there mechanisms other than just sort of the bully pulpit to try to bring this to bear?
Well, again, we have to understand that the United Nations is the center point by which most of this can happen. And yet we have, again, this Cold War stasis that took place where we had the Soviet Union and the United States and the West in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. Now we have almost the same kind of dynamic in the UN Security Council, which is the operative arm of the United Nations. So if they're deadlocked, not very much happens. And so now we have the United States versus Russia and China. The impact that it has on seeking global justice is we can't get anything done. And I would have thought, I'm the co-author of the world-famous Caesar Report, where we found direct evidence of war crimes and crimes against humanity by President Assad. And I remember briefing the Security Council back in April of 2014 to get them to refer the case to the International Criminal Court to seek justice for the Syrian people. And even that horror story that I told did not move Russia or China off their veto, and so nothing was done. Which what happens then is that since the Security Council will not refer Syria to the International Criminal Court, nothing will be done at the international level for some years to come. And that's a tragedy because we do need to seek justice for them.
I want to talk in a moment about what you did, the court in Sierra Leone, and the places where this has worked. But we should talk for a moment now about the International Criminal Court, just to give us some sense of what it is, who participates, and what's its jurisdiction.
Well, the International Criminal Court is a court of last resort, created from the Rome Statute in 1998-1999, which, ironically, the United States was a leading proponent in this fashioning the statute, which now creates the International Criminal Court. Yet we pulled out of it in 2001, ironically, by an individual named John Bolton, who was the acting U.N. ambassador from the United States. But the International Criminal Court is mankind's first permanent.
I should just say that now the president's national security advisor, but go ahead.
No, fair point.
Yes. He's been in the. I just wanted to point that out for those who have maybe missed the headline. Go ahead.
That's right. As I said in Poltergeist, he's back.
Yeah.
But the point is that. So it was a wonderful idea of creating a permanent court so we could refer these cases from states' parties to hold people accountable for atrocities. And so it's an important institution, one that needs to be supported. But yet, ironically, and I think this is important for our listeners, is that the three key countries in the world that actually commit most of the human rights violations, the United States, Russia, and China, are not part of the International Criminal Court.
And that's not surprising. And it's not surprising. I mean, you talk about Bolton, but of course he's working for George W. Bush, who at the time was sanctioning torture. It would make us very vulnerable if all of a sudden we were somehow accountable to international law when we said torture is an okay thing. And of course, all the international. And this gets to some of the trouble in trying to make these arrangements. I'm going to talk about that in a moment. But I do want to talk about your work in Sierra Leone, because there are places at least where some kind of international justice has been at work. So talk about your work in Sierra Leone.
Well, I had the honor and privilege of being asked by Kofi Annan after being nominated by the United States and the Bush administration, which was key in setting up the special court for Sierra Leone, ironically, to go to West Africa and specifically Sierra Leone to seek justice for the murder, rape, maiming, and mutilation of over 1.2 million human beings. I was placed in the middle of Freetown, Sierra Leone, right just like at Nuremberg. We were right at the scene of the crime. And my mandate from the Security Council was prosecute those who bore the greatest responsibility for war crimes and crimes against humanity. And so we broke up what I called the West African Joint Criminal Enterprise, or a lot of your listeners will be familiar with the Blood Diamond story. And you might have heard about the movie Blood Diamonds with Leonardo DiCaprio. The movie ends kind of sadly. It looks like the bad guys win. But at the end of the day, my team of people from around the world came in and put all of those individuals who were in the leadership positions and created the paradigm of Blood Diamonds there. We put all of them in jail. So I'd like to say that in this cynical world, the good guys won on this one, Frank.
You talked about setting up a secret Congo group as a way of doing this. Tell us about that group.
Well, what I did is when we began to prepare to arrest these individuals, I set up a security group, which we plan to take everybody down in one 55-minute arrest operation around the region so that there wouldn't be, hopefully, no unrest. So it turned into a military operation. We had a battalion from the British Parachute Regiment. We had the British West African Squadron of the Royal Navy. We had Pakistani Special Forces. We had American contract helicopters. We had Sierra Leonean National Riot Police. All came together in a operation called Operation Justice, where we arrested 90% of the perpetrators all at once, put them in a secret detention facility that we had built right under the noses of the individual who we arrested at his desk, the sitting Minister of Interior, Hinge Norman, and put them in jail, and they were prosecuted fairly and openly under an international tribunal a year later.
So by what authority did you assemble this group? And again, what was the rationale or the principle of law that governed the tribunal?
Well, of course, the mandate was to prosecute those who bore the greatest responsibility for war crimes and crimes against humanity.
UN.
Yeah, the UN established in August of 2001, UN Security Council 1315, which established the authority to create a tribunal called the Special Court for Sierra Leone. And that was done. And then I was appointed in April of 2002 to be the chief prosecutor, the second American since Robert Jackson in Nuremberg, to be given that privilege and honor. And I began my work in July of 2002 and left West Africa in July of 2005, largely done.
What is the impact on Sierra Leoneans, I wonder, with this kind of international imposition on them in terms of their sense of sovereignty and dignity, their rule of law that they would like to think that they have some control over? What about that relationship? It seems like a difficult relationship.
Well, again, international criminal law is arrogant. It's white man's justice, and the United Nations tends to go into a place that has been torn apart by horrors beyond description, step over the victims, and keep moving. I appreciated this dynamic. I was living among all of this death and destruction, and so I made sure my strategic plan focused on the victims. And how we did that is we created the world's first town hall program, where I, as something I learned in law school, went and asked my client what happened. And so I walked the entire countryside for the first 4 months, listening to them tell me what happened. So as I was drafting my indictments against these individuals who created this horror story, I at least had some sense of what these people went through. But they also got a chance to see me, talk to me, ask me questions, yell at me, shout at me. We laughed, we cried together. And for 3 years, I walked that countryside going back up saying, how am I doing? What am I missing here? Whatever. What that does is the people of Sierra Leone began to realize that the law is a good thing. Up until this point, the law was always used against them. And they suddenly realized that the rule of law is more powerful than the rule of the gun. And I used to tell them, I said, look, you know, in formats that would be amazing. I'd be standing on banyan trees. I'd be burned out villages. I'd be standing in crumbling town halls. But I told them, I said, don't believe what I say. Believe what I do. And when Charles Taylor's helicopter landed in our compound and he was walked to his jail cell, the most powerful warlord in Africa, and people around the court standing on rooftops and hilltops cheering, there were tens of thousands of them, they began to realize that, really, we should turn to the law. And what happened in Sierra Leone, a shot hasn't been fired since 2002 in Sierra Leone. They've had four national elections, and even the opposition won. And the losing candidate stepped down and never questioned the authority of the people of voting. So it's not perfect. I'm not here to say international criminal justice is perfect. But when it's done right, it's humble in its approach, international community can do amazing things.
And what about those biggest offenders, the U.S., China, and Russia? You know, you said earlier, it seemed a paradox that George Bush would sanction and allow, in fact, encourage you to go to Sierra Leone. But I wonder, I mean, that's a West African country, and it's not the United States. So sure, go spread your justice to them. But, I mean, here's, you know, when you talk about picking the bad guy, Saddam Hussein was a good guy when Donald Rumsfeld, as a pharmaceutical executive, was selling him the very ingredients he needed to make chemical weapons. And then he became a bad guy, one for geopolitical reasons that have yet to be fully disclosed. We went to war with them. So how do you, again, you talk about arrogance, how do you bring these countries to heel when they wield so much power?
Well, you don't. At the end of the day, when those three planes went into those three buildings, we began to slide down a dark slope, which we are still suffering. We began to climb out of it a bit in the Obama administration, but that's going to be a long generational haul. I grew up during the age of My Lai massacre, so it took 50 years for the U.S. to regain the moral high ground. Well, we jumped off the moral high ground, and we have not regained that. And what significance of that is that there's not one nation anymore where the world always said, we may be drifting badly, but we can always count on the United States to step in and follow the rule of law. We don't follow the rule of law anymore. Nothing matters in Washington. We have a current administration where the law is an impediment to them in their policies. And I don't want to go too far down that road, but what that ripples out at the international level, where I have a firm grasp of, is that all of a sudden America has become the bad guy. And, you know, and back in the Cold War, though we weren't perfect, we always had kind of the white hat on, and now we're the guys with the black hat, along with, sadly, Russia, China, the Philippines, Hungary, just a couple days ago, et cetera, et cetera. We're seeing these strong men starting to go into place and rule for life. If I think our current president could get away with it, he would probably join them. He can't, I hope. But, you know, it remains to be seen.
Yeah.
But, again, it has harmed. The loss of the moral high ground by the United States has started this process of unsettling around the world. We are at the most unsettled state that I have seen, and I'm an old Cold Warrior, and I've been fighting tyranny for pretty much all my life. This is as scary a situation as we have been since the Cuban Missile Crisis, where we were just one keystroke away from a nuclear war.
So
we are so unsettled.
Well, how do you see it going forward from here? Are you optimistic? Will things turn around in terms of international justice, or what's your impression of where we're headed?
Your listeners will probably be surprised, but I actually am optimistic. We have the rules of procedure. We have the jurisprudence. We have the experience to hold accountable. Mankind has made a political decision to do that back in the 1990s. So that's a huge Rubicon-type crossing event. So we do have the political concept of holding tyrants accountable. Now, it's a political decision, not a legal one. So the bright red thread of all this is politics, so hence the problem with the current political state. But at the end of the day, you know, I'll just give a perfect example to your listeners. You know, Charles Taylor, who we took down, the most powerful warlord in Africa and the first sitting head of state ever to be indicted, prosecuted for war crimes and crimes against humanity, just 12 years ago, never imagined he would be held accountable and then sit in a maximum security prison in Her Majesty's prison system in England for the rest of his life. So it may be slow, it may be imperfect, but at the end of the day, the rule of law will win out. And as I told BBC a couple months ago, there's going to be a knock at Assad's door, and it's going to be me.
The me is David Crane, and he is the co-editor of The Founders, four pioneering individuals who launched the first modern-era international criminal tribunals. He's also the founding chief prosecutor of the Special Court for Sierra Leone. David, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
David Crane is speaking at NC State University tonight, 6 o'clock, about the contemporary challenges to modern international criminal law. And we've got details at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.